Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I think my microphone is on. Yes. Anyway, it is Thursday, April 7th, 2022. It may look like February, but really is April. The first matter on our court's calendar for oral argument is the case of Scott Parks versus Covidian Holding Incorporated. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Would Your Honor prefer the center or the side? I'm not sure.
I think we're having you use the one closest to you, just out of an abundance of caution.
By all means. And I'll be able to go off the time on the center. Is that correct? Okay, yep. Just want to make sure. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, your honors, opposing counsel. My name is Michael Gorwitz. I'm here on behalf of appellant Scott Parks. Now, we are here this morning on two unrelated matters, only one of which is actually before your honors for a resolution today. It's been resolved, you know what I mean, on appeal. So in this action, Mr. Parks was injured when Covidian's surgical stapler malfunctioned in September of 2016. Now, he did not initiate a tort action based on that injury until September of 2020, when he became aware of the ability to bring the claim. Now, in the intervening 4 years between these events, he filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy protection in August of 2017, and he amended that petition in May of 2018. His Chapter 13 plan was confirmed in June of 2018, and the amended plan was confirmed in March of 2020. Now, there's no dispute that on none of these initial bankruptcy filings did he list the present claim. And that is the nature of the dispute here today. Not that he did not list it, but the ramifications for the failure to list that claim. Now, what this all essentially comes down to is the failure to check a box. Now, I don't want to at all diminish the importance of full and fair disclosures on bankruptcy filings. Mr. Parks very much believes in that. He merely did not know that he had a claim against Covidian that he had to divulge. And I'll just point your honors to Respondent's Addendum. This form is reproduced throughout, but this is just one place. This is Respondent's Addendum 2. You see it is just a list here, and it's just a box that is checked, yes or no, do you have a claim? There's nothing anywhere in the form that indicates if you do not check this box at this time, you will lose the ability to bring a tort claim based on this action. Now, that goes more to
Mr. Gorwitz, before we get much further, I want to make sure I understand the argument you're making to this court, just to clarify what we are being asked to decide. I believe your argument on appeal is that the district court erred in two ways, by concluding that judicial estoppel is an available doctrine under Minnesota law, and secondly, that the district court committed legal error by determining that three elements of estoppel are present here. Do I have that right?
Your Honor has that exactly correct. You've gotten ahead of my own argument here, which I should have cut to more directly, so I just wanted to lay the groundwork. But yes, we are only dealing with two legal errors. And so the first thing I wanted to talk about is the standard of review, so I'll just go directly into that. I'll highlight the four things first I want to talk about. The first is the standard of review. The second, as Judge Bjorkman has astutely pointed out, is that Minnesota's judicial estoppel is not available under the common law of Minnesota. I'd like to speak briefly about public policy related to whether or not Minnesota should adopt judicial estoppel under these circumstances. And then the fourth is that even if your honors were to determine that judicial estoppel is an available remedy, equitable remedy under Minnesota common law, that the elements of the doctrine are not satisfied under the present facts.
Could you address the last one first? What are the elements? Because it seems to me from the cases I've read, even if we were to determine that judicial estoppel could be applied or was appropriate in this case, it's not clear to me what all the elements are.
Yes, Your Honor.
For example, I noticed in the transcript discussion of inadvertence, but I didn't see that at all in the district court's discussion in its order.
And so I will circle back to inadvertence. I'll first give you the elements. I think it's easier to lay that out.
Oh, we know the elements. Why don't you tell me what you think that is missing from what the court analyzed? I mean, we just assume we've all read the cases here.
Yes, certainly. I know Your Honors are all familiar with the cases. So I'll just say this is drawing from State v. Pendleton. And what's often recited is there's no pat formula for judicial estoppel. As an equitable doctrine, it is left to the discretion of the court. Now, We would take the position that each of the elements are missing in this instance, and that is because Mr. Parks has amended his bankruptcy petition, now concededly only after respondent moved for summary judgment. And so there's no dispute that they moved for summary judgment and then he amended the petition. However, that was the only time that he became aware he needed to declare this on his bankruptcy. So there was no attempt to try to hide the ball or anything, Mr. Parks. Now, going directly to your question, Judge Siegel, the elements as identified by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Pendleton, and I just wanted to say one expository remark. The Minnesota case law will often discuss judicial estoppel and then circle back and say, we are not adopting it, but here are the general contours of it. So even though there is case law laying out certain guidelines or elements, that does not mean that the state has actually adopted the doctrine. So the three elements as identified in Pendleton are, first, the party presenting the allegedly inconsistent theories must have prevailed in its original position. Now, this is quoting from the U.S. Supreme Court in New Hampshire. A litigant is not forever bound to a losing position. We take the position this element is not satisfied because Mr. Parks has received no benefit from the bankruptcy court to this point that has been identified by Covidian. His bankruptcy has not been discharged. They have not identified any debts or anything that have been wiped away as a result of his initial bankruptcy filing. And because he has amended the petition and made the claim available to his creditors, there's no inconsistency between the bankruptcy proceeding and the tort proceeding, which is obviously not proceeding currently because summary judgment was granted. So currently only the bankruptcy is ongoing. He's currently scheduled to receive his...
Isn't there a case law that talks about a party prevailing when in fact a bankruptcy court does as it did here, namely confirm a debtor's petition?
Yes, Your Honor. So there is case law we would not dispute.
There's a lot of case law, isn't there?
There is. A lot is a general term, so I don't want to nitpick you on that, Your Honor. So there is multiple case law out there saying that mere confirmation of the Chapter 13 plan constitutes acceptance by the court. But what I would point, Your Honor, to is there is usually always some other factor going on in those instances that you have to show something, I'm trying to be precise in my language. Prevailing has to mean something more than just you checked a box on a form. Now, the case I would say that is most apposite, I always get those confused in my, the case that is most against us is Williams versus Hanji, the Seventh Circuit decision that Covidian relies on, because that is one that actually specifically centers on the mere confirmation of the plan constitutes acceptance by the bankruptcy court. However, there in those under the facts of that case, the plaintiff had already filed his suit 2 years before he filled out his bankruptcy form, and he also listed the medical debts that he was suing over as items on the bankruptcy petition. So the court found that he was really trying to actively hide those debts from the court, essentially, and under the facts of that matter. So whereas here, there's no allegations whatsoever that Mr. Parks has done anything to try to hide or anything that he was aware of these claims before he filed suit, since the bankruptcy preceded his tort action by so many years. But there is case law out there, but my main point is that usually it always involves is a discharge. And also what I'll say in Hanji is, I have the facts here, I can get you an exact number, but he had substantial debts wiped away as a result of the plan confirmation. And here there's no evidence of anything that Mr. Parks has benefited from the confirmation. So that is how I would distinguish the confirmation in Hanji, which was found sufficient, from the facts of the present case.
So you're equating prevailing with benefiting?
Yes.
The debtor benefiting?
Yes, just some sort, I would go so far as to say any sort of positive has been conveyed that has been established on the record, basically, whereas here there's not been any established benefit that Mr. Parks has received. I just want to make sure I have the exact language right here. Yes, the party must have prevailed in its original position. A litigant is not forever bound to a losing position. And so
counsel, your yes. argument assumes that we are looking at any benefit to Mr. Parks as of the time of the amendment of his petition, right? So, or today even, but certainly as of the time that the motion for summary judgment was argued. Some of the court's decisions, and I just want to pause here for a second to say that when we discuss a lot of courts or case law on this, we're really talking about a lot of federal case law, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there is some other case law in other states, but Minnesota's case law is pretty slim.
Yes, right? And that is a key point.
I just want to make clear that not all courts, and there are federal courts, agree with you that the point at which we decide whether a benefit has been conferred to Mr. Parks would be as of the amendment of his petition. Some of the courts have been very, very clear that it really turns on when the nondisclosure occurred. Was that a benefit to Mr. Parks? And it was, right?
I'm just trying to think. I don't want to, you know, give away a position that I don't need to.
Well, you know, it's a potential claim at the time he made the nondisclosure or failed to disclose, I guess would be a more concise way of saying it. And he effectively is preventing his creditors from knowing about a potential claim. And that is a benefit to Mr. Parks, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I definitely see your point there. And what I would say is the creditors, by not knowing of the claim, are at a disadvantage in that situation. But my position in response would be, in amending the petition, he has made the creditors aware and allowed the creditors to share in the claim. And so taking maybe one giant step back, equitable estoppel is a kind of an odd equitable principle. It doesn't look to the parties. It looks to the court system itself. And so judicial estoppel. I slipped up and said equitable estoppel, but I meant to say judicial estoppel. Those are actually two distinct equitable remedies. So judicial estoppel looks to the integrity of the court system itself. And so, Judge Bradfield, your question goes to, yes, at the initial nondisclosure, there is a harm to the creditors because they are not aware of the claim and able to share in it. However, our position, and because we're dealing with predominantly federal case law, as Your Honor pointed out, there is difference of opinion among the federal circuits, and we would point Your Honors to the Ah Quin case from the Ninth Circuit. I think that goes most directly to our point, is that in protecting the integrity of the bankruptcy process, if the tort suit is dismissed on summary judgment because of the failure to disclose, then the creditors are most put at a disadvantage because they are not allowed to share in the claim, which is the whole point of what bankruptcy is designed to protect, is to make the potential assets of the debtor available to the creditors in satisfaction of their outstanding obligations. And so,
does it make a difference here that not only did your client fail to disclose the claims of which he was reasonably aware, having had the experience alleged in the complaint, not only failed to disclose that in the initial petition, but then went ahead and amended petition and had a confirmation of his amended plan, still not disclosing?
Yes, and that is a very fair point, Your Honor, and just what I point, that was why I began with that lengthy recitation of multiple dates that obviously turns into a bit of word salad when you're spitting them all out aloud, but all of those events still preceded his filing of the claim, so I think the argument would still be that he did not become aware of the ability to bring the claim until after the amendment of the petition occurred. So yes, while the disclosure was not made on the amended petition occurred in, I just want to make sure my date's correctly.
So I want to pick a question on what I think I hear you saying, not being aware of a claim. I mean, that goes to the issue of mistake or inadvertence.
It does.
And I think Quinn picks up on the New Hampshire case out of the United States Supreme Court that suggests that even if the three elements, commonly recognized elements of judicial estoppel are met under the facts of a case, that a district court, you know, should go on further in deciding whether application of judicial estoppel is equitable, consider the question of mistake or inadvertence.
Yes, and
So is your position that the mistake or inadvertence is an element of judicial estoppel, or it is something that the district court, in exercising its equitable powers, would consider if the elements of estoppel are already made?
I think that is a key distinction that goes back to Judge Siegel's original question, which we have gotten away from, so I apologize to Judge Siegel for not directly answering her question. So there's kind of two things going on in Ah Quin that I think is kind of a key distinction to get at. So there's a line from the Supreme Court's opinion in New Hampshire that says where the failure to disclose is in judicial estoppel should not be applied in instances of inadvertence, basically going to the equitable principles that you should not harm somebody for an inadvertent mistake, essentially, is what New Hampshire discusses there. And so Ah Quin, there's two things going on. One in Ah Quin says, which I would say is more important than the inadvertence factor, is that the elements themselves are not satisfied. My client's position would be, where the elements are not satisfied, then you do not reach inadvertence, because if the elements of judicial estoppel are not met, then the question of inadvertence becomes moot because you don't have a doctrine to apply, essentially. And going back to Judge Bradfield's original point or question, that because of the plethora of federal case law we're dealing with here, because we have such little Minnesota case law on the point, because my key point, which I've not gotten to, which is okay, is that Minnesota has not adopted the doctrine, therefore it is not available to the district court to grant summary judgment on, is there's a variance across the federal case law of what constitutes inadvertence, and there's kind of a broad spectrum there. Some of it is very severe and says, essentially, so long as you know you were injured, you can't claim inadvertence no matter what the facts are. There's other federal case law that points in the other direction. So my point is...
But that would be something that the court, in its discretion, or in its in exercise of its discretionary equitable powers, decides after it is concluded that the elements of judicial estoppel are... present.
That is correct, and that is why we are not challenging.
So it's not your position that that's part of the test, or could be part of the test, since obviously Minnesota has not, state courts at least have not articulated a test or standard, correct?
I see I'm out of time. Is it all right if I answer?
You may answer the question.
Thank you. And I'll just note, just very briefly, in my rebuttal, I will try to use that to address more of the Minnesota. I think that is a key point we have not gotten to, which is, okay, I would like to address that in my rebuttal. So to answer Judge Siegel's question, I think inadvertence is more of an excusing factor if the elements are satisfied. If the elements are not satisfied, then you do not reach the inadvertence consideration. And because we believe the elements are not satisfied under the present factors, we do not believe that and you would even reach the question of inadvertence. Thank you very much, Your Honors. I will address the remainder on rebuttal.
Judge Bjorkman, if I may.
You may.
One more quick question for you, and it's really for your rebuttal, that last point that you made. Would you please indicate, if you have it readily available, what case law you primarily rely on for that?
For which point, I'm sorry?
Well, the point you just made, that, and I jotted it down like this, that inadvertence is an excuse that will be considered by the court only if the elements are satisfied.
In brief, okay. I would just say Aquin, but I will try to address that more fully.
Yeah, and preferably something in addition to Aquin, but thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, counsel. You will have time for rebuttal to continue the argument. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel Anupama Srikanth from Frederickson and Byron, on behalf of the respondents, Covidien Holding, Covidien LP, Covidien LLC, Covidien Sales LLC, and Medtronic. May it please the court. The central issue raised by this appeal is straightforward. Can a debtor who repeatedly represents that he has no claims against another party in his bankruptcy filings and who obtains relief through approval of a bankruptcy plan.
Can you, sorry to interrupt you so quickly, but why should your clients benefit from this? The bankruptcy plan has been amended, so the creditors are the only ones out. Your clients are not involved in the bankruptcy proceeding in any way, are they? Are they creditors? Are they? So, because some of the cases have involved said, no, judicial estoppel applies because the bank would never have approved this plan, Chapter 11 plan in bankruptcy if they knew that they were going to be turned around and there's going to be this claim asserted. So why should your clients benefit from this?
Thank you, Your Honor. The question of judicial estoppel, I think as counsel noted in his presentation, is based on the relationship between the litigant and the courts. And
no, I understand all of that, but why should your clients... I mean, counsel for appellant here has said, in fact, his creditors now can benefit, and there has not been a discharge. So why should this court adopt really the most harsh version of judicial estoppel from all the disagreement among all the federal courts that has never been applied this way, as far as I can tell, in the Minnesota state courts in this case?
Your Honor, it is a question of fairness, and it's a question of fairness to my clients because it's unfair for the appellant in this case to have taken an inconsistent position and to obtain relief.
But
in
did
both
your were proceedings. Your clients aware of that? Was there any reliance on that?
Your Honor's reliance is not an element of the test of judicial estoppel.
But
as
you said, it was unfair, and it's really an issue of whether we deem it to be unfair to the judicial system, correct?
Correct.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'll stop interrupting you. I'll let you in.
No,
continue on with your argument.
It's an important point, Your Honor, and I want to make clear, it is about fairness in the judicial system and the proper adjudication of claims and preventing individuals from getting two bites at the apple and to be able to get two two forms of relief that are favorable to them simply by changing their position in one case as to another. And that's a matter of the integrity of the system, it's the integrity of the judicial process, and it is a matter of fairness to my clients who now are in this position where they're defending a claim that was never disclosed to the bankruptcy court and the appellant.
Well, it's not really unfair to your clients, though. I mean, you can acknowledge that. It's a judicial doctrine.
It's about the integrity of the system, Your Honor. Yeah. And okay. I would argue a subversion of the bankruptcy process and the fairness of our system and the transparency and the proper.
Okay, no. You can continue on with your argument. I've taken you sideways far enough.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. So the question here is really, can a party who fails to disclose an action on his bankruptcy petition turn around and sue respondents 6 months after the plan is approved, seeking relief for the claim that he failed to disclose? And our position, Your Honors, is that under the doctrine of judicial estoppel, which is recognized here in Minnesota, he cannot.
Go ahead. Are you sure? Yeah. Okay. So, counsel, I'd like to ask you about some alternatives that are available for the courts to maintain their integrity. One is the amendment that Mr. Parks has already made so that this has, the nondisclosure has been cured, I think, under Mr. Parks' view. Second, I want to ask you, and this has not been briefed by the parties, but what other alternatives you have and the courts have to have this information presented to them, say this case eventually goes to a jury trial. Mr. Parks has, there's a record here, right? And it's sworn, correct? Which is, I think, your point about the integrity of the courts, right? Mr. Parks made a sworn statement of no claim. And then he filed a claim against Covidien. So now that, I assume, would be available for impeachment in a deposition or at trial. So would you comment on the integrity of the courts with those two points in mind, the amendment that Mr. Parks filed, and secondly, options for this evidence to come before the court and for, in fact, the integrity of the courts to be maintained?
Certainly, Your Honor. Let me start with your first question regarding amendment and whether the amendment has cured the alleged issue with respect to the creditors at this point. And I think this actually came up in the earlier argument today, which is, when do we consider the consequences of the nondisclosure? Here, the bankruptcy proceeding has been pending for 3 years before the amendment of the petition. During that time, the appellant obtained the benefit through the bankruptcy process.
Would you define the benefit to Mr. Parks, please?
Yeah, there was a bankruptcy stay. There was the ability to negotiate with his creditors to come up with a plan to repay debts that was then approved by the bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy process itself is a benefit, and the nondisclosure of the claim in the bankruptcy context was the premise of the bankruptcy plan that was ultimately agreed to and approved by the court.
So, but you're looking at one slice, because post-amendment, there are other procedures. I don't know a lot about bankruptcy, but I know enough that there are quite a few mechanisms available within bankruptcy itself to deal with things exactly like this, amended petitions. And then when I say deal with, I mean the creditors.
Certainly. Yeah. And I don't think we have anything in the record currently, Your Honor, as to what happened after the amendment.
I'm not asking about Mr. Park's particular claim. I'm saying there are a lot of procedural mechanisms for addressing an amended petition, right, in bankruptcy court.
That is my understanding as well, okay. Your Honor. And certainly the creditors would have some remedies in the context of the bankruptcy proceeding. My point, Your Honor, is simply that the consequence of the nondisclosure started from the moment the petition was filed, when it was amended, when the bankruptcy plan was approved, and then when it was confirmed. So, Your Honor, going to the second question regarding impeachment and the admissibility of this evidence in the underlying district court action. The products
in this district
case.
Court action, that's what I'm talking about, yes.
Yep. Okay. A sworn statement by the appellant, Mr. Parks, in the products liability case would be admissible under the rules of evidence. I think there's a question about relevance and the relevance that that would have to the underlying elements of the claim. We certainly haven't briefed this issue, but as I stand here today and consider your question, I'm not sure that there's going to be an opportunity for the non-disclosure.
Wait, you're using it today in this court to attack Mr. Parks' credibility, right? I mean, that is an aspect of your argument in focusing on this two bites at the apple and in talking about his failure to come clean in bankruptcy court. I mean, that's a credibility of any party is always fair game, isn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor. We have
about his case against Covidian. I mean, you're right. We couldn't talk about any other types of lies, perhaps, or there may be a limit on the types of lies or non-disclosures. But I'm struggling with your argument, counsel. Just argue that it would not be relevant
to the underlying product liability, the elements of the product liability case at issue here. I'm simply suggesting I could see a situation where there would be motions in limine and further proceedings in the district court regarding the admissibility. I don't know how the court would rule on those issues. But in terms of attacking the credibility of the appellant in this proceeding, Your Honor, I think if we look at the elements of judicial estoppel as has been articulated by this court in Bauer versus Black Duck, the elements are straightforward and they do not include an analysis of inadvertence or mistake or the reason for the non-disclosure.
Let me ask you that, the question that I asked appellant's counsel, and that is this lack of mistake or inadvertence, which I see in looking at the record and the transcript, that in fact appellant did assert in the district court, although the district court seems to dismiss that. But is lack of mistake or inadvertence an element of judicial estoppel, or is it something that a district court that has otherwise concluded the elements are met would consider in deciding whether to actually apply the doctrine?
Thank you, Your Honor. Under this court's opinion in Bauer versus Black Duck, it is not an element. That court articulated three elements: an inconsistent position, the same facts, and that position was accepted, or the first court was convinced to accept that position in the first proceeding.
And those are different elements than the United States Supreme Court articulated in the New Hampshire case. So part of my question is if Minnesota law would permit application of judicial estoppel, what elements should this court look to?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think you are right. There is a slight distinction between the federal articulation of the elements and the elements as set forth in Bauer. Federal courts do consider an element of benefit, but it's not based on whether the debtor actually did receive a benefit, but whether he could have received a benefit. And we see this in the Jones case, which is 811 F3rd 1030, which is an Eighth Circuit opinion. And I'll paraphrase what the court said. Essentially, judicial estoppel does not require that the nondisclosure must lead to a different result in the bankruptcy proceeding. So that is in the federal test. It is not in the state test. And for that reason, I would submit under the Minnesota articulation of the test, inadvertence is not required. Is not a part of the analysis.
Aren't you overstating the summary in Bauer? Because Bauer says that the doctrine is not reducible to a pat formula. We have recognized certain boundaries. So it seems like they're setting out the minimal boundaries in Black Duck, but not the full test, and inadvertence was not an issue in Bauer, correct?
Certainly, Your Honor. Yes, I think that's correct. To that, I would say that is the test those are the elements that the court set out in Bauer. Those are the elements that the district court applied. Those are the elements that appellant has argued here on appeal. And therefore, there's an understanding that those are the elements. As to the issue of fairness, I think that really does go to the district court's conclusion about fairness and its weighing of the equities, which notably appellant's not challenging in this appeal. If you look at his briefing, he's not saying that the district court weighed the equities incorrectly. His challenge is to the application of the three elements that are set out in Bauer, and that is the scope of the appeal today, not whether the district court was correct in its analysis of the equities between the two parties. Your Honors, I haven't spent much time on it, but I'm happy to talk about the recognition of the doctrine of judicial estoppel here in Minnesota and the Minnesota Court of Appeals and Supreme Court precedent on that issue. However, if the court has other questions, before I pivot, I'm happy to address those issues as well.
I can't speak for the other panel members, but I'm less interested in your arguments about whether judicial estoppel has been recognized or is available to a district court judge. I am interested in your comments in response to the argument appellant made about the impact of the amendment to the petition. There was an extended discussion about how the and it's reflected in federal case law that many courts view the three elements of or three or four because it's a flexible list. The elements of judicial estoppel differently, you know, do the analysis post-amendment before reaching a decision as to whether to apply judicial estoppel. So would you, because this judge clearly decided that the amendment would not alter the analysis of the three elements. Mm-hmm. So please comment.
Yep, and Your Honor, not to repeat myself, but I would point this panel to the Eighth Circuit's decision in Jones, which talked about how judicial estoppel does not require that the nondisclosure lead to a different result. And it's just the fact of the
I'm not talking about the result or detriment. I'm talking about the analysis of the three issues. So, for instance, we already had a discussion about integrity of the courts. Is that effective? And we've talked about did that cure, and I respect your position. But we can go down the elements and talk about each of them differently, depending on whether we look at the amendment or not.
Yes, and Your Honor, for the disclosure requirement in bankruptcy to have meaning, it has to be enforced in this way, would be my position. Otherwise, a litigant could simply not disclose until and unless it is raised by an opposing party in a context such as this, and then amend and then argue that judicial estoppel, this doctrine that's been recognized by hundreds of courts around the country, should not apply because it was cured after the fact. It doesn't cure the initial nondisclosure and the effect that creates and the application of judicial estoppel under
so
these facts.
So what difference in your understanding of the test, at least the one you're advocating for us to adopt, whether, I guess I'm getting back to inadvertence, whether it's intentional, whether it's fraudulent, you know, working a fraud on the court. And how do we analyze that piece?
Yes, again, Your Honor, I don't think that is an element under the Minnesota test. And frankly, we don't know in the record whether it was intentional or fraudulent. We're certainly not making that assertion here. It's simply the nondisclosure issue. And I would say there are cases that say that ignorance of the law is not a defense to judicial estoppel. And we cite in our briefing to the Clay versus University Cancer Specialist case and Clover versus J.C. Penney Corporation. And that's particularly true when the debtor is represented by counsel, as he was in this case. And again, we have a situation where there was an initial petition, an amendment to the petition, and then a district court action, and no amendment after the filing of the district court action. It's only when the respondents move for summary judgment in the district court that there is an amendment. And certainly, by the time appellant filed the case in district court in Anoka County, there was knowledge of the claim and an understanding that proceeds would have, in any lawsuit here, would have been a part of the amounts recoverable to creditors. And I do see that my time is up, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this. One of the cases appellant relies on, and I think makes some persuasive points, is the Ah Quin decision out of the Ninth Circuit. Why shouldn't we be persuaded by the Ninth Circuit's analysis on very similar facts?
Your Honor, as we've noted in our briefing, I think the factual distinctions in the case are not on point. And moreover, that case is for the general proposition that approval of a bankruptcy plan meets the elements of judicial estoppel, and application in that case the application in this case is appropriate.
It doesn't look like there are additional questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, with the 5 minutes that I have remaining, I have not forgotten your question, Judge Bradfield. If you allow me to just go to a different question you asked respondent during, because I think that gets to one of the key issues we have not talked about so far, which is the public policy considerations. During respondent's portion of the argument, Judge Bradfield asked about what alternatives are possible. And so Judge Bradfield's question, I believe, kind of centered upon the tort proceeding, but I would actually like to redirect that question back towards the bankruptcy proceeding, because one thing that's also gotten, you know, we've gotten very interestingly deep into the weeds on this one is that there's almost no connection between these two actions. You know, there is no, the bankruptcy has no impact on the tort action whatsoever, except for whether or not the claim is available to the creditors, which is why the amendment is crucial, because it makes the claim available to the creditors and resolves any inconsistency between the two proceedings. But the to answer Judge Bradfield's question of what alternatives are available, I also want to get back to Ah Quin, which is the last question that Judge Bjorkman asked respondent. In Ah Quin, the Ninth Circuit pointed out that the bankruptcy system already provides plenty of protections. The bankruptcy court or trustee may reopen a case if it uncovers deception. A bankruptcy court or trustee can impose sanctions, including denial of discharge. And of course, a case may refer to United States Attorney's Office for criminal prosecution. Now, by no means am I suggesting that Mr. Park should be referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for criminal prosecution. I would be disbarred if I suggested such a thing. However, the point I'm trying to make is the bankruptcy judicial, as I talked about in my main point, judicial estoppel centers upon the integrity of the court system. The bankruptcy court possesses all of these tools to protect the integrity of the bankruptcy filing. If it is determined in the bankruptcy, which is the only place that these questions are germane of whether or not his, that's why, not that inadvertence is not an important question, but it almost seems more germane to the bankruptcy than it does to here. And now maybe this is my way of answering your question, Judge Bradfield, about the interrelation between the elements. I mentioned Ah Quin, that's just some quick using my computer here, I apologize for this. So in New Hampshire v. Maine, which is kind of the main Supreme Court case on the point, I'm sorry I don't have specific page references for you, but first they go through the three elements as articulated, and then there's a lengthy discussion of some other things. And then after that, they say this, and I can get you a pin site if you need, but we do not question that it may be appropriate to resist application of judicial estoppel, quote, when a party's prior position was based on inadvertence or mistake. So that is why I was taking the position that it's set out separately in the opinion, essentially. So you have the elements, then you have this as a sort of mollifying factor, even if the elements are satisfied, that where inadvertence or mistake is present, it may, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, it may be necessary to resist application of the doctrine under those facts.
But and isn't that where Ah Quin went with it ultimately? I mean, the Ah Quin opinion, I mean, the court articulates what you just said, and that is that the bankruptcy court has other ways to maintain its integrity even when there has been non-disclosure by a debtor. But, I mean, the court then went on to say, you know, when the plaintiff debtor has reopened the bankruptcy proceedings and has corrected the initial filing error, the narrow interpretations of mistake and inadvertence do not apply. And in fact, as I read Ah Quin, the real guts of the analysis was on sort of that overall equitable question of whether the failure to disclose was due to mistake or inadvertence. And I think you've told us that isn't the issue before us in this case.
I didn't want to go so far as to say that isn't the issue, so I would like to take one step back.
Okay, that's fine. But do yes. You agree that that was the focus of the Ninth Circuit's analysis in Ah Quin?
I do, with one slight clarification, and that is, and this is kind of this very deep level that we're at here with the relationship between inadvertence and the elements, because yes, Ah Quin did center on a reinterpretation of what inadvertence or mistake means within the bankruptcy filing, but they also address the elements, and so while I do maintain that they are separate, I do think they also speak to each other and are two important aspects of the Ninth Circuit's decision in Ah Quin. And if you'll apologize for a somewhat lengthy quotation, this is just where they address the elements themselves. And the Ninth Circuit said, once a plaintiff debtor has amended his or her bankruptcy schedules and the bankruptcy court has processed or reprocessed the bankruptcy with full information, two of the three primary New Hampshire factors are no longer met. Although the plaintiff debtor initially took inconsistent positions, the bankruptcy court ultimately did not accept the initial position. The Supreme Court put it well, this is quoting from New Hampshire, absent success in a prior proceeding, a party's later inconsistent position introduces no risk of inconsistent court determinations and thus poses little threat to judicial integrity. Now back to Ah Quin. Moreover, the plaintiff debtor did not obtain an unfair advantage. Indeed, the plaintiff debtor obtained no advantage at all because he or she did not obtain any benefit whatsoever in the bankruptcy proceeding. And I just wanted to get that back in front of your honors, because I think those two aspects of the Aucoin opinion, I think they speak to each other, even though they go to different elements, that once you have made a full and fair disclosure to the bankruptcy court, not only have you removed two of the three New Hampshire factors, but it also alters the inadvertence or mistake analysis, that instead of adhering to some of the case law that really takes us very draconian approach to what constitutes inadvertence or mistake, they take a more common sense approach under that. That may not be the exact language of the Ninth Circuit. I apologize if I'm not getting that right. I don't have it in front of me. But that those two aspects of the opinion are speaking to each other would be my position, that where you have made a full and fair disclosure. And just the last thing I want to end on is, this is where you started with respondent, is that the only parties really taking advantage in all these case laws of judicial estoppel are tortfeasors, who are using as a technicality to get out of responsibility for their actions. They are not actually interested in protecting the integrity of the bankruptcy system. If there are any remaining questions, I'm happy to address them.
I'm seeing none, and your time has expired.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you both for your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory